did she come in? Did you see her come in?
I did my waiting! 12 years of it! In Azkaban!
You're gonna suffer.
Hmm?
But you're gonna be happy about it.
What a load of rubbish.
Where did you come from?
When she get here?
Ladies and gentlemen, the Epic Film Guys Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another live stream for The Cure 2.0 special spotlight for Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. I am Epic Film Guy Nick.
And I'm Epic Film Guy Justin, and yet again we are joined by the self-proclaimed God of Podcasting, our own Potter expert himself.
The Hermione to my Harry to your Ron.
The Choss, A1 Cost, Loss, Boss. Astos. I don't even fucking know what I'm saying here. Welcome, Loisa.
Can we use the time turner and go back so Justin can give a better intro than that? The God of Podcasting,
hey,
please.
Hey.
Man. Loisa. Welcome.
Thank you for having me once again.
Loisa. That guy. In the house. Absolutely
thrilled.
That
is me.
Absolutely thrilled to be here to talk about the third installment in the Harry Potter franchise. And if you haven't tuned into the last two installments, just to kind of break this down for you, Loisas, again, is our Hermione, we've decided. He knows everything.
That is the second time you've spoken out of turn, Miss Granger. Are you incapable of restraining yourself, or do you take pride in being an insufferable know-it-all?
And, you know, he's coming into his... own femininity in this film.
It's extremely accurate. I had my first PMS when this film came out. So.
Wow. And Justin is our Ron. He's just whimsical, and he has a pet rat, and he's a nasty ginger, and nobody.
I'm
likes
telling
nasty
you right
ginger.
Now. I want Scabbers trilogy. One thing walking away from this film before I go any further, give me a Scabbers trilogy. I don't care what happens after this movie. If I don't see more of that damn rat, I'm going to be disappointed. So,
give
me the fucking rat.
Yep, Justin is our noob. Justin's our Potter noob. So he's only seen a few of the films, never read any of the books. And I, of course, am our Harry, the glorious hero who will smash he who must not be named at the end of the day. I have seen all the films at least once or twice. And I absolutely love the franchise. So that's the angle that we're all approaching this from. Gentlemen, it's time to talk about The Prisoner of Azkaban. And Loisas, why don't you let us know what it's all about?
So, as Harry Potter enters his third year at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, he is developing some pubescent emotions, and he is going through a lot of turmoil in his mind, which leads him to blow up his aunt like a balloon, which is an amazing sequence.
Have I mentioned how much I love the Dursleys in this whole series? Like, every sequence at the Dursleys, I love it. I love it so much.
I think you might have, yes. But as Harry returns to school, he learns that 13 years ago, a supporter of Lord Voldemort, he who must not be named, who shares a connection with Harry, a mysterious connection that is revealed later on, but he was imprisoned in Azkaban for murder. But now he has escaped and is looking for Harry because he views Harry as the only thing standing in the way of you-know-who's return. So, and then also, it is discovered that there is another supporter of you-know-who lurking within the castle walls. So not only does Harry have to go to class and learn new things as a Hogwarts student, he is also evading a serial killer.
All right, and it's safe to say that, and we did talk about it when we did the Chamber of Secrets spotlight, but this one I feel like territory's a little darker even. It's a little bit darker this time around. I think because, of course, Christopher Columbus out, and Alfonso Cuarón coming in, directing this film. So you definitely get a lot more. It just feels like a much, much darker, much more serious affair. You do still have some fun, whimsical scenes. Blowing up the ant at the beginning of the film is a perfect, perfect example of that. There are some other examples of it, but yeah, this is kind of the film that I really view where Harry Potter really starts to grow up, I think. And I mean, it makes sense because they're 13, so they're all hitting puberty, but yeah. Justin.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things that we see Harry Potter do is after he does blow up his aunt, which is an extremely fun sequence to watch, you know, he decides to leave his life with the Dursleys, as far as I know, because I haven't seen the one after this. So I don't know what happens after the fact, but, you know, he takes a stand. And up until this point, we've kind of seen him be pushed around by them a lot. Whenever we see those scenes with him there. So he stands up for himself. You know, he tells his aunt, shut up, and he walks right out. He grabs his luggage and he's out of there. And that's what leads him onto his journey back to Hogwarts. So for me, like that's definitely a large step for the character himself to kind of be like, fuck this, I'm done with this shit. There's no reason for him to be there. And coming from my standpoint, watching the film, I'm sitting there and I'm like, why is he there? Why is he still there anyways? It doesn't make any sense. He's got friends in other places he could go to, like, even though legal guardian aside, get out of there. So for me, that was a great opening to the film. I thought it was extremely fun. But definitely, Nick, the main thing coming off of this as a noob, as you like to call me, in the Harry Potter franchise, is this film looks a lot different. It feels a lot different. Now, we're with these characters that we already know from the first two films. Again, they're the same. They're developing and they're growing, but you have that comfort level there. But man, does this movie look different. It's one of the things, Loisos, that you had pointed out to me before I saw it. You're like, no, you're going to maybe be a little bit in shock over the difference in how the film looks. And you were definitely right, because the camera never stops moving in this thing. I swear to God, it's very smooth, though. It's not like it's awkward movement, but it's always moving with the characters. It's always going around them and sliding and swooping. It's never sterile and just kind of placed in a very stale type of shot. Like, it's always trying to be interesting and innovative, and I think that Cuarón being the director adds a lot to the reasoning for that. But it feels like an auteur sat in the director's chair in this film. And I love Chris Columbus. Believe me, he was, again, the right guy to do the first two. But there's a certain level of expertise and class that comes in when you see this film for the first time.
Loisos, how do you feel about the night bus?
Oh, I love the night bus scene. Like, when I was reading the book, it's exactly how I imagined the night bus to look and move. It's this really wacky scene, and John Williams composes this really bizarre kind of scherzo where it's like all these clashing instruments, and like, it really helps the scene with a certain sense of energy and wackiness to it. I'm not a huge fan of the shrunken head, I have to say.
I love the shrunken head. The shrunken head's hilarious.
I like the idea of the shrunken head, but I don't know, grates on the nerves a little bit. But I love Ernie with the driver with the huge glasses. Oh, yeah. And
yeah, the driver's great. The driver's probably the best part about the bus.
It's so much fun.
It is. It's a really fun sequence, and I feel like what these films try to do is they try to give you every single time before you get back to Hogwarts. We've talked about this in the other spotlights, but they give you a little bit more of the wizarding world. And this time, instead of going straight to Hogwarts or instead of whatever else, now we go and we meet David Thewlis's character, Aries. I mean, Remus Lupin.
Oh, God. You reminded me of Wonder Woman. You're welcome.
We get to meet Remus Lupin, who, of course, is our new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. Yeah. So I think he's great in this film. He's actually one of the best additions to the cast this time around. We'll talk about some others as we go on here, I'm sure. But man, do I love his character. I think he's a really, really great character. And we definitely haven't seen the last of him, which is really, really great. And I can't wait to just kind of revisit all those other moments he's going to be part of. But Justin, what did you think of Remus?
I love the character, and I love David Thewlis a lot. He's one of those British actors that show up in a lot of movies, especially a lot of the British gangster movies. One of my favorite gangster movies, Gangster Number One with Paul Bettany. He's in it. He's amazing. He plays a character called Freddie Mays. And so the whole time I'm sitting there watching this, and I know Lois also doesn't know, I kept going, Freddie fucking Mays, you fucking cunt bloody bastard. And I kept thinking of him in that way. But he's a very interesting character. And as soon as I knew he was going to be on screen, I was really excited about that. This character has a very special secret, which at the end of the movie,
would you believe that Remus Lupin has lycanthropy?
Wink, he's a lycanthrope. Wink. Oh, he's a lycan. Yeah.
Wink, wink, wink. He's a fucking werewolf.
Supposedly, I read, Brian, I don't know if this is correct or not, but Thewlis had auditioned for a role in Chamber of Secrets, but got turned down. And then he got the role in this. I don't know if you know anything about that, but I thought he was a great addition. I mean, the cast in these movies so far, being the noob that you're calling me, I've had no problems with right off the bat. I love how in each film they're bringing in a new character, or at least so far, a new teacher at Hogwarts that have been interesting and exciting to watch. And I hope that continues. Emma, yep.
Emma Thompson is the professor Trelawney.
This movie. Oh my God, she is incredible.
I didn't even know it was her. And I was like, wait, who? And then I was like, oh my God, she literally sinks herself into that role and that character and looks, I couldn't even tell it was her. She's so good.
Oh, she's amazing. I want to get from that though, because of course, Richard Harris tragically passed after, right before actually the release of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. So of course they had to recast one of the most pivotal roles in the entire franchise, which of course is Albus Dumbledore. And Michael Gambon. Thoughts, Loisos?
It takes some getting used to. It's at first it's a little jarring because he does lean into the very kind of flamboyant side of Dumbledore. And
Just to jump in here, not to cut you off, but I'll say it's incredibly jarring because literally his first scene as Dumbledore is him standing up in front of the entire hall at Hogwarts, and he's like yelling and like projecting, and that is not Richard Harris's Dumbledore at all. And I mean, maybe that's Michael Gambon putting his stamp on the character from the get-go.
Yeah, but exactly. He said he was unconcerned with like really changing or copying Harris. He wanted to just do his own interpretation, and actually putting a slight Irish accent on for the role. I didn't hear that. Maybe I didn't listen close enough, but
it's definitely there. Yeah.
Now, I had read, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but they were talking about bringing in Ian McKellen into the role.
That's right. Yeah. There was, but it would have been too close to Gandalf from the Lord of the Rings.
Close.
As a noob, it didn't bother me, but I'm sure for those of you that grew up watching these movies, and especially you, Brian, maybe it was more jarring than it was for me.
It's jarring. I don't mind him in this movie. I actually love little moments when Harry and Hermione return after setting everything right with the time turner and everything, and they rush into the hospital wing, and Professor Dumbledore's walking out, and they're like, Professor, we did it, we did it. And he's like, did what? Good night. And like, just... I love
he just gives
that
him, like,
line
that little,
read and
that little subtle nod, kind of that little subtle
wink. So great.
Yeah.
It's so great. I have problems with his portrayal in the next film, which we'll talk about in the next.
Saying that. Yeah, we'll get to that when we get there. Yeah, by the we'll end, we'll say, we've already finished that. So.
Once the films continue, I think you really, especially in the fifth and sixth films, I think he's just absolutely fantastic. But it does take some getting used to as a fan of the way Richard Harris portrayed that character.
Yeah, it is. For me, Michael Gambon was my Dumbledore because he was the first one that I saw, because the first film I saw in this franchise was Deathly Hallows Part One. So for me, I got to come back after the fact and experience Richard Harris in the role and then see Michael Gambon take on the role. I will 100% agree with Lois Oss when we talk about Goblet of Fire, but we'll save that for when we get to that spotlight. But yeah, I think in this film, I think it's definitely different, but I do like he's got a lot of kind of really nice character moments with Harry and with Hermione that are really, really nice in this film. And I think we can't really go any further without talking about Hermione, because in this film, almost I would say more so than any of the other films in this franchise, she is my favorite character in this film. I love Hermione Granger. I love her anyway, but I love her in this film especially. And one of my favorite recurring gags in the entire Harry Potter franchise is literally throughout the first half of the movie, she keeps showing up out of nowhere. And every time Ron Weasley's like, where did she come from? How did she get here? Like, where was she? Every single time, I absolutely love it. And of course, it's that thing where once you watch through the movie, you realize she's been using the time turner to take more classes than you could possibly take in
all
a day.
Of the classes.
Literally all of them, which is great.
In this movie, just like Harry is standing up for himself, Hermione is also not taking any shit whatsoever. She is completely not having any of Professor Trelawney's nonsense. She punches Malfoy in the face.
Yeah, she punches him in the face and it looks real. it's like there's a huge impact when she hits him. I love that
saga. Legitimately one of the greatest scenes of the entire saga when she just like hauls off and decks him,
slugs him, dude, hard, and like you feel that punch. Like I loved that scene. I didn't expect that. I really didn't see that coming at all.
Yeah, that was absolutely amazing. So I love her in this film. I really, really love Ron in this film as well. And I love Harry. I really think the core trio of characters, like every film so far in the franchise, I think they've grown more into those characters. They've grown more comfortable with playing them. They've kind of made the role their own just that much more. I mean, of course, it's always been theirs, but just even that much more.
One of my favorite stories about the series is that when they were first starting out, Coran really wanted the Golden Trio, as they're called in the fandom, to, as like an exercise, he assigned them an autobiographical essay where he assigned each of the actors to write an essay about your character and really kind of get into your character's head and the emotional experience of the character. And of course, Emma Watson turned in like a 12-page essay.
Shocking.
With like all of these footnotes, and it was very long and complex. And Daniel Radcliffe turned in like a 1-page essay, pretty simple. And then Rupert Grint didn't turn in his essay. He never did the assignment. And when Coran asked him, like, why didn't you turn in, what happened to the essay? He said, well, my character Ron wouldn't do the essay. That's Coran was like, okay, well, you understand your character. That's exactly what your character would do.
That's perfect. That is literally perfect. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite stories, about the behind-the-scenes stories of the Potter franchise. is Coran tried to get these young actors to really get inside their characters' heads, and they understand their characters perfectly just from the outcome.
Yeah, exactly. Because Hermione would write a 12-page essay.
That's one of the things I love about these characters. They're so different from one another, but yet they're this strong, cohesive unit. The more you see them interact with each other in these films, you just feel like they're a family, more than best friends. They're literally hard to pull apart from one another, and I love seeing them work together. But I got to tell you right now.
Yeah, can we talk about some of the aspects of this film that suck?
Well, no, let me talk about my favorite. Okay, before we get to the stuff that sucks, okay, it's a very special thing called a hippogriff, and God, did I love this thing. I love the creatures of these movies. I mean, being a kid watching these movies, that's what I would have looked at and been
Draco
excited
Malfoy's
about.
Ass.
So it really brought me back to being a kid in the 80s and watching like the Neverending Story. When you see Harry jump on the hippogriff, he's trying to like master this relationship real quick. And then when he jumps on him and he's flying around, I love that whole sequence so much. It brought me back to being a kid again. And it's got those strong fantasy elements you would expect from a movie like this. I absolutely fell in love with that scene. Buckbeak
the hippogriff. And a lot of effort was gone into make that character, that creature, realistic. For example, like one scene, Buckbeak just poops. Just like, I wanted to point it out to you, Justin, but I think we missed it. But I mean, that's just a small detail. Like, but you know, they put real effort into making.
I mean, it's a living thing. It takes a shit.
Exactly.
Man. It shits on stuff.
Exactly.
It shits.
Well, speaking
but
of taking shits on
that's
stuff.
That's attention to detail that I really
speaking
like.
Speaking of taking shits on stuff, I feel like Loisaz is eager to do it.
Let him go.
Right here,
let
right
him
now
go.
With this film. So go ahead and lay into it.
All right. Well, as a fan of the books, I think this is one of the sloppiest adaptations out of all of the film series. I don't want to harp on it too much because this is a film after all, and not the books, which I understand. Of course, the first two are long films, and the fact that they include every detail, some may view as a hindrance. I know that this is probably the best reviewed of the series. Prisoner of Azkaban is the best reviewed of the series critically. But as a fan of the books, like, I understand that, but there's so many things missing from this film that I feel like is even integral to the storyline that's just not included at all. It'd be nice to know who Mooney, Wormtail, Padfoot, and Prongs are, what the importance of the map is, inconsistencies in the world. Like, I can't stand the opening scene when Harry's using magic outside of school, and then the very next scene, he uses magic outside of school, and Uncle Vernon says, "You're not allowed to use magic outside of school." And then he gets in trouble for it later on in the series. It just, to me, it's like inconsistencies like that really bug me. Not only does the movie differ from the book, which I can take, but I also just feel like this movie, the pacing is just so breakneck and so quick.
It really is, yeah.
That it doesn't give you a chance to breathe and really soak in the world like the first two. It almost feels like a claustrophobic experience because it's just nonstop, like, information. And if you, like, you have to be paying attention during this movie because there's so much dialogue and quick back and forth and exposition that's just quickly brushed over and move on to the next thing. It kind of gets frustrating to watch, in my opinion.
I would agree because, I mean, if you think about it, like, this is shorter than Chamber of Secrets was by a good 20 minutes or so. And I really think this film could have used those extra 20 minutes to kind of pad out everything. Think about, like, you get introduced to Hogsmeade in this chapter here, and you don't really get to spend any substantive time really learning much about it. To the where you could probably ask somebody who had just seen just the first three films, what's Hogsmeade? They'd be like, a town next to Hogwarts. That's probably about all they'd be able to tell you, really.
Yeah, but I mean, not only stuff like that, but like exposition that I feel like is important, like stuff with Harry's dad at school is like really important to the character, and I feel like we need to know, like, some of Sirius Black's backstory, which we didn't even touch on Sirius Black yet, but I don't know, stuff like that I feel like is so important to the storyline and it's missing.
Yeah.
If you haven't read the books, you might not get the full experience of what exactly is going on. I mean, Justin, you haven't read the books. So.
No, I haven't. And I definitely agree with you 100%. Like, coming off of watching the second film and then the first one, like, where things are laid out in a slower fashion and you get to soak it in, you get to take your time with it. In this movie, I definitely lost some stuff. So it's probably one that I should go back and rewatch just to get some details. I definitely didn't pick up every little detail because of the breakneck speed of the pacing. It was way too quick. I didn't like that it didn't give you a chance at all just to breathe. Like, hey, give me a shot of Harry in his bedroom just sitting there. Think, you know what I mean? Like, give me something to, okay, I can breathe for a minute and soak in that last scene I just watched and all of the dialogue and information I was fed. But we do have to move on to Sirius Black because I think it's one of the most important things about this film. I mean, we got Gary Oldman in here as Sirius Black, and there is a lot of hype behind this character in this movie. They build up this character so much before you even get a chance to see him in person. It's insane. Like, I feel like he's such a strong presence before you even get to see him. It's awesome. And I really like that it takes a little bit of the hype away from the, well, whatever you want, name not to be said or whatever.
close enough.
Whatever. Hey, I'm a newbie.
And if you think about it, this is the only, I believe this is the only film in the entire franchise that he does not appear in whatsoever.
That's right. Yeah.
So you do not get any Voldemort in this film whatsoever. I mean, of course, they name drop him a few times here and there, but you know, you get to see him as, you know, young Tom Riddle in the second film, and you get to see him attached to the back of Quirrell's head in the first one, and then we'll get, you know, to later films in the franchise. But yeah, so it really tries to kind of paint Sirius Black as like this. I mean, of course, you get these crazy, crazy shots. I actually put up in the live stream, which you guys will see when you can watch this live, but just the shot of the newspaper of, you know, them struggling with Sirius Black, and he just looks like a crazed, like, savage lunatic, which is really, really great because it really kind of plants that idea in your head as a viewer for the first time that, you know, wow, this is like, you know, just Gary Oldman sells this so well in just like little newspaper snippets of just like this repeating GIF on the front of a newspaper.
I love that whenever they're in a scene and you see it and it just keeps repeating the same thing, but you're like, it's such a presence to be felt in the film, and coming in and knowing it's Gary Oldman as a fan of him, you know, you're automatically like, wow, you're expecting something great. And when he does show up on screen, I think he's fantastic. And I love the little twist that's there, that it's like, oh, things aren't as they seem.
Yeah, and when you first see him and the camera zooms in on him and John Williams comes in with the score, dun-dun, it's a literal dun-dun-dun, like it's a huge moment. And Gary Oldman's performance in that scene, he has waited so long for this moment, and you get that sense of desperation and that sense of, like, I love that line read that he does, like, I did my waiting, 12 years of it in Azkaban. Like, he's bursting at the seams to just murder this person.
That's the other great thing, too. You bring up Azkaban as well, because this is also, we'll get a lot more of it, especially in a couple of films coming up in the franchise. But this is also our first real big dip into Azkaban prison with the Dementors, who are just creepy motherfuckers.
Oh, man. Amazing imagery. Probably, if I had to put one thing on my top of favorites list for this film, that would be it. That imagery alone immediately set this film apart from the previous two for me, especially being a hardcore horror fan. With the inclusion of a werewolf and the darker tone and the darker look to the film's more muted. It's less colorful in a lot of the
desaturated
scenes.
Yeah.
You know, the Dementors, beautiful imagery. There's a shot I remember where they're just like floating. It's like it's at night, moonlight, and you just see like a handful of them just floating there, and like a hand goes in front of the camera in front of Hogwarts, and I literally was in awe, and I'm like, this is the movie for me. This is what I love. This is what I live for.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, Justin. I love, love, love the imagery of the Dementors, and that's like the first time that the Dementor shows up, you know, on the train. You know, they're on the train, they're on the Hogwarts Express, and all of a sudden, the ice, I love that just kind of idea of, you know, just sucking all of the heat, sucking all of the life out of literally everything around it, the windows and everything frosting over. And then, of course, like I said, you have Aries saves the day. I mean, Remus Lupin saves the day.
Damn it.
You know who else is great in this film? And I know you guys I've got some other stuff you want to talk about, but you know who else I think is great in this film? After you didn't really get quite a lot of him in Chamber was Snape. I think you get a lot of really, really great Snape stuff in this film.
Turn to page 394.
I love him in this role, and more it makes me so sad. Especially, and I knew that I was going to be this way when I watched this series, because, I mean, I've watched him in a lot of other movies, but knowing that he's such an integral part of the series, every single time he's on screen, he's always oozing charisma. He's always so fantastic, especially with this character. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about this. I may be slightly off my rocker because I'm just watching these movies for the first time as an adult, I guess. But I think this is the role that he was made for. It just fits him so perfectly. I mean, I can't
absolutely.
Even, after watching him in this, I mean, watching Die Hard, it looks like it's a different person. To me,
the first choice for the role was Tim Roth, and he went and did Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes instead. But good imagine Lord. If Tim Roth, or like, we wouldn't have gotten Alan Rickman as Severus Snape if that. I mean, because he is perfect for the role.
Rickman as Snape, though, I mean, it's one of those things where you don't want to picture anyone else in that role because Rickman is so good in that role. And like I said, you get to see a lot of really great scenes with him. The scene where. With turning the page and everything like that, I love, like, he's sitting there like watching Ron, and like Ron's fumbling with the book, and he immediately like wands it and flips the thing over to the right page. There's the scene where he has Harry and Malfoy are dueling. There's a lot of really, really great, you know, and you know who we haven't talked about enough in these spotlights is Tom Felton.
Yeah,
I love Draco
Tom Felton
Malfoy.
Is Malfoy. He's perfect.
I hate him. Literally, but like, and then like later on in the series, like, especially
he's such a sniveling little bastard. You just want to,
but man,
I feel like that this role hurt his career. I think that's why he's not doing shit. He also plays a sniveling bastard in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Like, does this guy ever get any good career moves? No,
he's great, especially in the back half of the actual saga.
Yeah,
the later films. He becomes less sniveling, but like, the layers start to just expound upon that character. And I mean, you got to see it in Chamber, especially with the way that his father is and the way that his father treats him and treats not only him, but treats other people. And, you know, like literally like has that Aryan bent about him where he only wants
definitely.
Pure blood wizards. Only pure bloods are what matter. He whips out mud blood a couple of times in this movie as well. And then I love that
Hermione. Definitely some social commentary.
Blood, right? I got it right this time, right? Mug blood.
Mud blood.
Mud blood.
Yes.
Mug blood. What the fuck? Mug blood.
He's trying to combine muggle and mud blood.
I think that's what he is doing.
Mug blood. Mud blood.
Anything else you guys, I know there's probably a bunch of other stuff you guys want to talk about the film. Go ahead.
Oh, there's so much.
Jump right into it, man.
Oh, man. Can we talk about the fact that this is the Back to the Future Part 2 of the Harry Potter series?
It really is. Yeah, it definitely takes a page out of the playbook from Back to the Future 2. I actually really enjoyed those elements, the whole time travel element. And
so clever.
Yeah,
I love it. It's my favorite part of this film, to be honest. And without it, I think it would knock this film down probably an extra peg or two. I think you're right, Lois. It's incredibly clever. I really, really love it.
Well, and the way they tie it all together, too, like when the werewolf first starts coming toward the trio, it's going to attack Harry and it hears a distant howl. And then we learn later on that was actually Hermione trying to distract the werewolf so that it wouldn't kill Harry. And it's so like I can only imagine J.K. Rowling sitting down and like writing this sequence and planning it all out. And it's smart. It's clever. I mean, there's a reason why Back to the Future and Back to the Future Part 2 are the greatest time travel stories ever. And this takes a page out of that book, rightfully so. It's so incredibly well done. Again, in the movie, it doesn't go into the fact that time turners aren't something to be trifled with, and that thus, like, they're all destroyed in the books. It's like, you shouldn't meddle with time because bad things happen. So all the time turners in the books are destroyed, because that would be kind of a deus ex machina when it's like, what do we do? Oh, let's turn back time and fix everything. It's like, nope.
Yeah.
But anyway.
The film does not address that. You're right. I've heard people make that complaint about the films before. It's like, well, why don't they just use a time turner and go back and stop Voldemort from killing Lily and James and all this stuff? And
read the books.
Yeah, I think you just have to.
Yeah, but I'm watching the movies. I don't need to read the damn book.
Yeah, I think you just have to be able to get past that stuff, and you just have to be able to ignore it and not get too consumed with it, because I love it. Like it's like you said, Lois, it is by far the most clever part of the film. I love, like, they're throwing the rocks, like Harry and Hermione, you're throwing the rocks into Hagrid's hut and smash the vase. And then that's what alerts them to the fact that, you know, they're coming to kill Buckbeak, and then they save Buckbeak after the fact. And like, I just love all those little moments of like the close encounter kind of thing. And then it ends up being Harry who summons the Patronus that ends up warding off all of the Dementors and saving Sirius Black. And I just love it. I really, really like this movie. And I mean, I've never read the book, so I can't really look at it from Lois Oss's point of view. But what I really do wish there was more of was more, and you get it in later films. So it's a little bit of me wanting to jump ahead into the series, but I know I can't yet. But I want more of Sirius Black in this film. I don't necessarily know if you get enough of him in this film. Like,
you hardly get any
everything,
in the fourth.
You guys
kind of
talked about the pacing being breakneck, especially in like the final act of the film, like when it's revealed that Scabbers is actually Peter Pettigrew.
Scabbers! Oh my god! Right? Oh, that legit shocked me. I was not with Brian's like, pay attention to the scene because it's going to connect into something later on. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. And then when it hit, I was like, oh my god, it's a dude, man.
It's really, really, I think about the long game that requires on Pettigrew's part to be Ron's rat. Or first he was the twins' rat, and then they
the twins'
him
rat,
Ron,
yeah, first. Then know, he was passed on.
And everything, but like, even still, like, it's breakneck. Like, you go from being, like, the whole film tosses this red herring, this giant red herring of Sirius Black at you, and then it immediately rips the rug out from under you and is like, okay, boom, he's not really a bad guy, okay.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, Sirius Black is like, Harry, come live with me, and Harry's like actually considering it, right? And it's like, Until a few minutes ago, he was, you know, yep. You thought he was going to murder
you. We were pissing our pants about you, dude.
Right. So it does seem like a quick turnaround in the movie. And I think that just speaks to how screwed up the pacing is. Again, like I really wish the film had given you some more information and let you sit with it rather than just go from one set piece to the next. Yeah. I mean, it's such a complex book. It's such a dense book. And there's so much going on that it's incredibly difficult to try to get all this information into one movie. That's why they were considering splitting Goblet of Fire into two movies mm-hmm. initially, because it's, you know, the thing's like 800 pages long. Yeah. So I can only imagine it being an incredible challenge and undertaking to adapt any of these books into film. So I don't want to hold it against the movie too much, but just as someone who's read the books, I can't help but have kind of a bias towards this film and just how sloppy of an adaptation it is. I do think it's an incredible film visually, the tone of it, the feel of it. And I think there's great character depth, especially as Harry learns these truths about him and his family and his past. I mean, that's a very heavy subject for an actor to deal with. And I think Daniel Radcliffe does a great job, especially in the scene when he learns that Sirius Black is the reason that his parents are dead, or, you know, as we think.
His anger is palpable in that scene, and it's really, really great.
When he says, like, I'm going to kill him, like, yeah. You believe it. Yeah. He's, like, seething with anger and hatred, and I mean, I can't say enough good things about this movie, because it really is, as a film, it's definitely up there as one of the best in the series, but as an adaptation, I think it
that's I where think the it terror really is, suffers. Man. That's always where the terror is. But why don't we, before we get into our final ratings on the film, do we have a trivia code? Or do we have a trivia question that we want to ask for
what
this film?
What is that
film?
Trivia question Ooh, for that baby. Ultra 4K HD digital code for the entire eight-film series?
All eight films. Remember, every all single film in the series, part one's now closed. You can no longer answer the question for Philosopher's Stone, but Chamber of Secrets and Prisoner of Azkaban, because they both premiered during the live stream for The Cure, both will be available until Goblet of Fire comes out, until we do that spotlight. So Loisos, go ahead, baby, take it away, lay it on us.
Alrighty, for your chance to win all eight Harry Potter films on digital HD, here's the question: how many times does Hermione turn the time turner to turn back time?
Well, that's
there's
a
some alliteration in there.
Say that Ooh. Three times fast.
There's some alliteration.
All right, so I'm gonna say it one more time. So,
and just to be clear, we're talking about in the infirmary to go back to fix everything.
Yes. Okay. So, how many times does Hermione turn the time turner to turn back time?
If I Damn could it. Turn back time.
No, you're gonna Thank bring you. That'll that be in all. Here. Huh? Yeah. I listened to that song actually yesterday. My
keep
80s
listening
playlist.
To all yeah. of these spotlights every single time you answer a question correctly. You get another ticket into that drawing where, at the end, when we review Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, you have a chance to win so many Harry Potter movies. It's just going to make your freaking face sick. I don't even know. And then Voldemort came and killed everybody. Spoiler alert. Not really.
No, that's the next film.
Boom. Oh. I can't wait to review the next film. But before we get there, let's jump around the panel here. Starting with Justin, final thoughts and a rating for The Prisoner of Azkaban.
If it weren't for Scabbers, then this film would get a 4 out of 10.
I love Scabbers. Scabbers is my favorite character of the series. I have rats, people that are listening. I actually have pet rats. I've loved rats. I like the character of Scabbers. But
are they also animagus?
I'm going to give this one a little lower rating than the second one. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. I think it's still pretty good. I still enjoy it as a film. beautiful to look at. God, there's some great elements in there. I just think comparing it to the second one and watching them back to back in such a short time period, I think I just really preferred the second one a little bit more. There's the action sequences are better, and I love the fact that it's got werewolf in it. It's got darker elements and scarier stuff, and you know, these ghouls that float around. And I think what the best thing that it did is it set me up to be excited to see what's to come in the next few films. So 7 out of 10 for me.
All right. And before we get over to our Hermione Loisos, our Harry Charles Potter Acorus guru, I'm going 9 out of 10 on Prisoner of Azkaban. I love this movie. Gary Oldman, you add into the mix, David Thewlis, who I absolutely love. And like I said, I think that Chamber of Secrets does not utilize Hermione well enough. And Loisos, you know, nailed it right on the head. He said that was more Harry and Ron in that film, and this is more Harry and Hermione. But man, I love Hermione Granger. I love that character. So the more of that character you get in this, especially because she's turning back time literally and going to every single class at Hogwarts, which is just still amazing. Like, because it's when you invest yourself enough in these characters and you've watched through all these films, and I'm sure Loisos can even attest, when you read the books, it's such a Hermione thing to do, to go back in time just to be able to take more classes. Like, not for any, like, ill-gotten purpose or anything like that, which is why Dumbledore trusts her with a time turner in the first place, because it's Hermione, and he knows that she would use it legitimately just to go back and take. It's such a great thing. I love the time turner aspect of it. I think it's really clever, and this is where Harry Potter, like I said, it starts to grow up for me, and this is where the performances of all the kids start to get that much better as they age, and it's a great, great film. And especially with what we have coming up next, really, really great by comparison. So 9 out of 10 for me.
9 out of 10. I'm going to have to go ahead and give Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban an 8 out of 10. For me,
suck it, Justin.
Again, no, I mean, I understand where Justin's coming from. I have problems with this film's pacing. I have problems with it as an adaptation. There are a couple of things here and there that I don't necessarily agree with, the way they presented certain aspects, certain things. But this is definitely the deepest and darkest and most emotionally complex of the three that we've reviewed so far. This is one of the most aesthetically beautiful entries in the franchise, bar none. I think Alfonso Cuarón did a great job in helping expand the wizarding world and giving us a certain sense of the unknown and darkness and a level of whimsy. I mean, just the visual imagination of this, you get talking shrunken heads, you get, you know, crystal balls and pooping hippogriffs and
scabbers.
You get people changing into animals and animals changing into people, and all of these little touches, candy that makes you roar like a lion. And I mean, the amount of creativity on display in this film is incredible. And it also deals with some really human emotions in ways that the previous two did not. So for all my reservations with the film, and again, a lot of it just comes from me being a Harry Potter nerd. I know a lot of critics and a lot of people who are not necessarily Harry Potter fans proclaim this to be the best in the franchise. I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't necessarily agree with that, like I said, but no, but look it up. I mean, I think this is the highest rated of all the Harry Potter films.
I don't disagree. I think it's either the highest rated or it's one of the highest rated. I know that for a fact.
Yeah, and I think that just has to do with, again, the level of skill that Cuarón demonstrates in building the world, and just everything from the camera movement to the color palette to the way the scenes transition from one to the other, the change in seasons, transitions of the bird hitting the tree.
Yeah, with the Whomping Willow. Yeah, great.
Oh, God. I love seeing, this is a side note, I love seeing winter in these films. God, do yes. I love it. And especially in this one, the way the snowflakes fall past the characters, it's gorgeous to look at. God. And if anyone's interested and you have a 4K setup and you haven't jumped on this set yet, my experience so far with the three that I've watched on Ultra 4K, this is a set you need to get because it's beautiful. Absolutely stunning. The fine grain, the detail, every little bit, it's stunning.
One of the best things about this film is, too, is that pretty much at every opportunity, Harry puts Draco Malfoy in his place. literally every time, like, punks him outside with this, when he's wearing the invisibility cloak outside, throwing snowballs and pushing him down and stuff within the duel and everything like that, completely owns him. And it,
one of the best Malfoy moments happens in the next movie. So,
oh yes.
Yeah, he didn't really get the upper hands at all on this one. Whereas the last two, he kind of had something up his sleeve. He felt like more of that. Whoa, this guy can cause some shit to happen. Yeah. And this one, he felt like just he didn't really have any power at all.
Yeah, he doesn't have the power over Harry that he did in the first two films, which I think is really, really great, and is a testament to, you know, the continuity from the last film where he stands up to his father and is like, "Yeah, bring it, motherfucker. I'm Harry motherfucking Potter, bitch." I don't think that line also made it in the cut.
Are we gonna mention the fact that in the last film, Lucius Malfoy was about to murder Harry? He literally starts to say Avada Kedavra, which is the killing curse.
Right.
He was literally about to murder that child until Dobby steps in.
Of course,
and
you love that. Of course, you love that.
Well, you know, I do love the murder of small children, but I'm just surprised that Lucius Malfoy would just murder Harry Potter right then and there for setting Dobby free. But
it's one of those things neither here that nor there. Like, I wish, because I love Jason Isaacs' performance as Lucius Malfoy so much, I really wish that character was in every single film from Chamber of Secrets on. I'm pretty sure he's in most of them. I know he's in 5. He's in 6. He's obviously in...
He's in...
Is he in 4?
Yeah, he's in 4. He's at the Quidditch World Cup at the beginning.
Yep, you're right. Yep.
I don't know if he shows up again in that movie.
I don't know if he does either. But yeah, he's such a great presence in the second movie that he's sorely missing from this one. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, part 3 of our Harry Potter Spotlight Retrospective in the can. Next up,
your favorite
Goblet of Fire.
I'm gonna love it. I'm gonna purposely go out of my way to love it just for you.
I can see Justin loving it.
I hope I do.
It'll be tough to go, but I want to save it. We'll save it for the discussion when we get there. But ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all very, very, very much for listening. You guys are amazing. We appreciate it, and keep taking part in those trivia questions, because every single correct answer is another ticket in that drawing to win the entire Harry Potter saga. We're also giving away Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I think we're just going to do that as a one-off on that actual spotlight, though. So stay tuned for myself, for the God of Podcasting, the A1 Loy Steak Choss Sauce, Cost, Moss, Goss, whatever other word rhymes
that
with sauce.
Fucking Loy
that guy. Oh. And for Justin, thank you all very, very much for listening, and
we will see you at the movies.
Ha ha ha.